sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Stocks explode. GDP is kind of lackluster. And lots of promises from Europe. Today, we have special guests John Markman and Joseph Brusuelis from Bloomberg, who's going to be talking to us about GDP. We'll get his thoughts on that. And we are going to talk about some stock ideas that we have and a look at what's going on in the week ahead. All this and much more on episode number 273 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to the last week of July, going into August 2012. And this is Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. And there's so much going on right now. Did you see that amazing, incredible, remarkable, absolutely crazy market reversal on Thursday and Friday? It looked like during the beginning of last week, there was some significant sell-offs, a lot of distribution going on above-average volume. As a matter of fact, if you are one of the folks that reads IBD, Investor's Business Daily, they put markets back into a correction after quickly putting it up in a confirmed uptrend maybe 3 days before. And then all of a sudden, we're back into a confirmed uptrend, according to them. They're having a difficult time because the normal cycles, the normal clues and indicators that are giving people the idea of a trend direction are absolutely broken. There's no question about it in my mind. The fact is that trying to figure out which way a trend is going is just not possible. We're in a choppy environment that every single word that comes out of Europe that may be somewhat better is, well, taken to the to a degree that's quite incredible. Last week we heard Mario Draghi say they're going to do whatever is necessary. And you know what he says? It's going to be enough. I promise you that. And markets said, wow, isn't that great? They're going to do something. And on the heels of that, because it went over so well, we saw that Francis Hollande and Angela Merkel from Germany said the same thing. They said, whatever we need to do. And again, that move. Then finally, the thing that really, really had some incredible movement and a reaction was when there was some murmurings that, in fact, the ECB's Mario Draghi is going to be meeting with the Bundesbank to talk about the potential for additional LTRO, or quantitative easing, or possibly directly buying bonds of some of the sovereign nations like Spain and maybe Italy and maybe Greece. And all of a sudden, boom, the euro goes flying higher, which was interesting. We'll talk about that in a second. And at the same time, markets just went berserk. It was well-timed and maybe just coincidence, but we were at a point of very, very good resistance of the markets. And right as it was said, shorts covered and the markets blew up dramatically. And we saw a reasonable amount of volume come in. And oh boy, things just went a little bit bonkers. Vertical. We're not even talking about slightly up. We're talking about vertical in a matter of minutes on Friday at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And there you have it. You know, even though we see a GDP number that comes in at 1.5 that a lot of people are saying was a lot better than the 1.4 that was anticipated. But the reality was just a week before, there was about a 1.9%, and that was drawn down. In other words, there was analysts who came out and dropped down their overall ratings. The consensus came in a bit lower, and it was only a week differential. We'll talk about that in a moment with Bloomberg's Joseph Brusuelis. And I want to remind you that, of course, this episode is sponsored by GoToMeeting. And hopefully you were there to join us last week as we had a GoToMeeting or a GoToWebinar where we had Steve Dahl on talking about task tools and how to really get down and understand the market profile concept and support and resistance. I would tell you at about this point that we had it on a recording, but that didn't work out so well. We'll have another one, and we will put the recording up. So I apologize for that. But it was really great where we were able to both actually work on the project and the presentation together, passing it back and forth, where Steve and I were talking. We were sharing his screen. We were sharing my screen. And that's the great technology from GoToMeeting. You can get your free trial. You can just get 30 days absolutely free of GoToMeeting by going to gotomeeting.com/podcast. I recommend it very highly. And all you have to do is when it comes up, you look at it and say, hey, try it free and put in the promo code podcast. And there you go. You got it. So that's great stuff. Gotomeeting.com. Gotomeeting.com. Go right there. A couple of ways to get in there. But gotomeeting.com, put in the promo code podcast, and you're all set. Great stuff. Now, I want to talk to you about a few things that you need to be aware of. First of all, it's the end of the month, and we do, of course, have that rotation that goes on, where oftentimes you see that the worst players are moved up and possibly a reallocation. We saw finally, bonds start to sell off. If you look at TLT as an example, an ETF that actually tracks the long bond, it finally sold off. And it hadn't sold off in, I can't even remember how long we saw that it just kept rising and rising and rising. One of the reasons could be that when the announcement came that they're going to buy some bonds and possibly come in with an LTRO, that there was a reallocation from U.S.-based sovereign bonds into many of the bonds of Europe. That makes sense if it actually comes through. But I got to tell you something. I have seen, and you have seen, so many times that Europe has come out with some announcement or another only to disappoint us. Because you know what? The fact is, if you really break it down, you look at what they said, there was no plan behind any of this. We know the Bundesbank is still very negative on any kind of bond purchase or share debt exposure. And I don't know how they're going to convince them unless this is a Hail Mary. An attempt just saying, you know what? Like Paulson did back in the day, getting on their knees and saying, you know what? If we don't have this, it's going to end. And it's going to be very bad for everybody. We can't get ourselves to get any kind of play in the markets. Nobody's buying the bonds really to speak of. We have debt rolling over that's pretty incredible coming in the next few months with Spain and Greece. And you know what? If you don't fund us, we can't pay our bills. And if we can't pay our bills, Mr. Germany, you know what? You can't pay your bills because you're in for a lot of this right now and your economy is slipping as well. We saw that their output manufacturing, their consumer confidence numbers looked pretty poor. Our consumer confidence came out last week and it was the lowest of the year. But nonetheless, investors bid up stocks in the spirit of, hey, Bernanke's going to do something this week, which I think is a little bit of a long shot. And at the same, except from talking, of course, and, you know, kind of trying to talk up the markets. And at the same time, you know, Europe is finally doing something. But they're doing something, again, is just words. I bet that when this all falls down, when this all comes down to push comes to shove next week, you know what? I would venture to say that there's going to be some skepticism. What happened on Friday was a lack of desire for anybody to hold positions overnight into the weekend with a big announcement potentially coming. But when reality hits, we'll see what happens. The markets are very vulnerable to any news headline, and it really is primarily central banks right now. Because the economics aren't really moving things that much, unless there's a void in any kind of discussion from, you know, anybody in the area of central banks around the world. So you have to realize that the old term that says, you know, you can't fight the Fed. No kidding. You can't fight the Fed. But you know what? It's even worse than fighting the Fed. Fighting an army of Feds. So be careful. Take a look at what's going on and, you know, leg into positions right now, which is what I think is the best thing to do. Get the strongest positions you can with the highest fundamentals so they can withstand any kind of major shocks. Buy dips. Yes, I'm saying it. Buy dips. Reasonable dips. When markets are coming off and there's a wholesale sale for, you know, no reason other than somebody sneezed or coughed. And, you know, keep on building into those positions of yours until they break down past any kind of support levels. Now, we're looking at a lot of stocks that are breaking out, some of them to new highs, as a matter of fact. And they're actually closing in on some gaps right now. And that's an interesting place to be because those are the areas that you really see a lot of very fast movement in securities. So, you know, when you see something like the Amazon, which it kind of takes down on poor earnings, then moves up, that's a signal. That's interesting. It's a little bit of euphoria, but it's a signal nonetheless. And realize that right now, the idea of central banks stepping in, and they have been, by the way, you know, you're seeing a lot of countries reduce rates, adding stimulus. China's actually kind of doing some of their own stimulus addition right now because their economy is starting to slow dramatically. And at the same time, we're seeing economics fall off, so there is more reasoning for it. You know, pay attention. You know, be aware of that and take a look. Now, one of the things that also happened last week was that the margin requirements by the CME were dropped for futures. Not on all futures, but on sector futures of the S&P. Now, it's interesting because there was a lot of conversation that I saw around the web talking about, hey, this is a conspiracy, and take a look at what's going on. The CME drops it, so therefore it's a lot easier to buy more, because when they take down margins, which means that, you know, you have less money that you have to invest to get the same exposure. So if you have the exposure, you could actually leg in and add more to it, which is, the opposite of when they increase margins, where all of a sudden people have to sell off things and close positions because they're getting too close to a margin call. Can't leverage as much. So what I did was I went back to 2000 or so. I called up the CME because the information about their historical margin change are pretty hard to find. They bury it. They even admit it. The only way I can get there was they had to walk me through where it was actually on the web, because they couldn't find it either. So I went back and I looked at the historical S&P 500 futures contracts margin changes from about 2000, and I charted those. Those will be up on the Disciplined Investor this week. Now, what did I find? It wasn't as clear cut as some people made it out to be. Is it a conspiracy? I don't think so. And the fact, I think it was kind of surprising with the results. When you take a look, what we did is we put a chart up. We marked on the chart each time that the margin was either increased or decreased. And then you could see what happens in the next day, week, month. It's not what you'd expect, I don't think. You would think there would be a pretty much an automatic move to the upside if margins were decreased, and downside if the margins were increased. I'll tell you this, and I think it bears looking at, that when you see margins increased successively in short term, in a short time period, there is the added influence, I would say, about the margin requirement, and that does in fact probably have something to do with the fact that as stocks are coming down, or as markets are coming down, you know, they come down a little bit faster. Now, does the margin decrease make stocks go up faster? There was no evidence that I could see. But take a look at that. That will be up, I believe, on Monday. We're going to post that on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It's a pretty wide chart because it covers a lot of time period, a long time period, and you should take a look at what's going on with that, because I think it's kind of interesting. I'll mention also, don't forget about checking out DH Unplugged this week. We're going to have some interesting conversation about Apple, I'm sure, about their discussion with Twitter and their possibility of investing there, as well as what's going on with Facebook or not. And that was a pretty big disappointment also. But also seeing some interesting movement in stocks, particularly in the area of, we'll call it, consumer discretionary / eateries and food, because the cost of goods have come up dramatically. You know, we're seeing about an 85% increase in the cost of chicken over the last several months because the cost of corn has been escalating dramatically. And who does that affect? So, you know, we have talked about Buffalo Wild Wings before. We had a short on that. We talked about that on Trigger Point Research, and we did have a short alert on that and made about 18% on that drop. Closed the position on the overnight hours. And I'll tell you something. We're starting to look at that one again as a potential short candidate. And there's a few others out there. We actually posted up a list of about 13 different stocks. You can see that Monday as well. 13 different stocks that look like they're setting up. Now, they're not actually triggered at this point, but they are something to start looking at. And for you out there that have a subscription, you'll get it, of course. And if you don't have a subscription, you can get a 14-day free trial. You know about that over at triggerpointresearch.com. And take a look at that. But this is going to be, we'll make sure that this particular post and alert about the different stocks that are coming up into setups, we call them, will be available to you. So check that out. I do want to get to our guest because I have a lot of things to talk about with John Markman. He and I go back and forth a lot. But I thought we would start off today with a conversation with Joseph Brusuelas, because as soon as the GDP number came out on Friday, I thought he would be the perfect person to talk to about what's going on and how to understand it a little bit better. So let's kind of start off with that, and then we'll talk with John Markman, and then we'll come up with a couple other things that we should be looking at from an economic standpoint this week, because it's a big week, and we have a lot of earnings happening too, and I'll give you a heads up on some of the earnings that you need to be aware of. So with that, let's get to our first guest, Joseph Brusuelas with Bloomberg. He is an economist there and a great guy to talk to about things related to not only the economy, but the global picture. So I thought we'd figure out what's going on with GDP. Joe, how are you? Tell me a little bit about what your thoughts are on the recent GDP number.
Well, you know, I don't think anything really changed based on the GDP report and the back revisions of 2009. In fact, I think things could have been much worse. As I look at the data, it just confirms that, you know, we're stuck in a slow growth phase where we'll do well to grow somewhere between 1.5 and 2% for the remainder of the year. You know, what I thought was really interesting is inside the report, you know, economists like me, we're going to look at these reports a little different probably than most investors. And I saw something I actually liked. You know, we got a shift in the growth mix away from an over-reliance on government spending towards growth based on private sector activity. Now, that's what we need to do in the long run. Now, I'll acknowledge in the short run that's going to be very challenging because the disproportionate burden is going to be borne by the working class, and that does mean we're going to have slow growth for some time. But, you know, we have to have a healthy mix of private sector growth, smart policy, and unfortunately austerity, especially at the state and local levels where they have to balance those budgets. This is the economy that we have, and it's best that we all just recognize it for what it is and begin to put in place policy measures that create certainty on taxes, on regulations, and entitlements over the long run that one would hope over time would convince businesses to take that $1.7 trillion that's sitting on the sidelines and begin to invest it in equipment, in software, and most of all, in hiring people.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting was that I saw a site recently. It was I think, on CNBC or Bloomberg, and it talked about jobs. And it was called TaskRabbit, where people can go and they can get jobs that are maybe one-off kind of task-related, picking up cat food or dog food or washing a car or doing all sorts of things. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on how that may create an interesting gray market for jobs right now. And if that is something that maybe is a good thing, where we're seeing that maybe there is a lot more potential underground jobs brewing, or if that is something a little bit different. And also, I think you recently tweeted about the rise in inventories and how that may be something that affects the GDP going forward, because that is looking like it may be a little bit problematic in the next quarter. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's right. I mean, well, first of all, in the gray market, we do have a structural unemployment problem. Monetary policy can't fix that. That's going to take retraining of workers and smart fiscal policy. Second, on the gray market itself, you know, we've always had a gray market here, especially in areas like Los Angeles, you know, and in the Southwest, where we absorb a lot of immigrants. Now, what would be really disheartening is if formerly officially employed Americans are turning to the gray market for work. That would indeed be a sign of an intensification of that structural problem. So while, like you, I am following those anecdotes, I don't want to see those anecdotes increasing in intensity over the next several years. We need to see official hiring people come back on the books, pay taxes, become productive citizens. Now, with respect to the last question on the inventories, yeah, we inventories accounted for well over a third, actually close to 40% of growth on the quarter, and that does indicate that there's some downside risk in the third quarter as consumers and households continue to spend cautiously. You know, one of the more interesting things we're going to be talking about here over the next several weeks is what a firm's going to do ahead of the Christmas season. Are they going to build up inventories the way that they have? You know, implied in many of the growth forecasts in the third quarter is we're going to get a big inventory build in the last month ahead of Christmas. But the way I'm looking at these inventory numbers here, boy, one has to think that firms remain unconvinced about the strength of aggregate demand and the condition of the consumer. And that could set up for another disappointing Christmas season.
But doesn't the low inventory level really speak to the potential for profitability of companies as they're keeping inventories lean moving forward?
Well, over time, yes. I mean, we're just talking about growth in the current quarter and the third quarter. Remember, when you're building inventories like we built in the second quarter, you're borrowing growth from the future. And so, you know, that's why you tend to have the volatility in growth. And because growth is at 1.5%, what you don't want is for the economy to decelerate further to 1%, where you risk, you know, getting stuck at stall speed. And once you're at stall speed, you know, a stiff wind comes over and it can knock you into recession. But over time, we are going to have to manage those stocks better and those inventories better. And that does bode well for profitability. But of course, the problem is that, you know, we've got a consumer who for five straight quarters spent more than he brought in. And now we're going to go through another one of these adjustments. And that adjustment always entails an adjustment in inventories.
All right. I want to thank Joe Bruswellis from Bloomberg. You know, you can catch Joe on the Morning Joe, Cup of Joe, or there's a YouTube channel. We'll put a link on the website for this particular episode. Check it out. He talks about all about the economy and things you need to know in like about a 5-minute little discussion. Check it out. Thanks, Joe, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Anytime, Andy. All right, bye.
Maybe it was I don't know if that was me or did you hear that clicking? I don't know what's going on. I think there was we'll have to take a look at what's going on with that and try to clean that up somehow. But there was a weird clicking. I hope you didn't hear that. But if I hear it, you probably heard it. Anyway, let's kind of segue into a conversation with John Markman, because I think that there's some things going on in the markets that he has. He has a great understanding of seasonality and the kind of cycles that go on, but also a lot to do with individual stocks. And he's just a really great resource of mine. And I really think that I'd like to share some of the or ask him to share some of his thoughts on what's going on in the world and some of the sweet spots that are right now, because he's been doing a lot of work in the area of emerging growth. But anyway, let's kind of talk with him. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we have John Markman here. John Markman and I are good friends. We talk quite often, chat back and forth about all sorts of things, exchange information. He's a writer of 4 investment newsletters. We'll ask him about that in a second. And he's a columnist for MarketWatch, TheStreet.com, and some more coming. John, how are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. A little bit rainy here in SoFla, in South Florida, but been watching. Hey, did you see the Olympics, the opening ceremony?
I did. I thought they were fantastic.
I thought it was great, too. Did you? Maybe I was a little bit disappointed because of the experience I had with the Beijing Olympics. How mm-hmm. incredible. I mean, that was goosebumps. And this was great. I mean, where they brought up the Industrial Revolution part of it, where they brought those towers up and the lighting and all that, that was really kind of amazing.
You know, the lovely wonderful thing about the British is that they have a fantastic capacity to laugh at themselves.
Yeah.
And I thought that the show was hilarious in places, in a way that, you know, China could never be.
Right.
And I think that, you know, Great Britain, that British people are so confident in their superiority that they can, laugh at themselves and invite other people to do so. And I thought the bit with the Queen and James Bond
was
just perfect.
Yeah, that was great. That
and
was great.
The fact that he was able to pull that off perfectly was a marvel.
Yep.
And I also thought that the fireworks crescendo near the end was really well done. And finally, I thought that Sir Paul McCartney sort of choking up on the first bars of Hey Jude was just the perfect touch.
Yeah, no, I thought that was great. I'm looking forward to it. And I was watching some badminton this weekend. That's a great sport. I love that. So fast, like 150 miles an hour, those little birdies go. But anyway,
I love badminton from my days at summer camp.
Yep.
And my kids and I play it all the time. And it's fantastic to watch it professionally or in the Olympics, because very tough sport. Very that bird is flying much faster than a tennis ball, and so those guys are incredibly well skilled.
Yep. Speaking about moving fast, we saw a lot of movement last week when markets were reacting to some of the information out of clearly Europe. I mean, the correlation between the euro itself or the dollar, anybody want to look at it, but really the euro and the S&P 500 is quite remarkable. We keep a track of that on a intraday basis, and it really is a pretty much a one-on-one relationship. But what happened in Europe last week was it was kind of a point where you really wondered how much longer they can go on with rates as high as they were with Spain when they hit in the mid sevens. And there was some talk about, what's going to happen next. And then all of a sudden we get this surprise announcement by the ECB, Mario Draghi, who came out and basically said, hey, we're going to do whatever we have to do. And then we saw, of course, the Germans and the French come out and say the same thing. Hey, I guess they said, hey, that line really worked well. So they said the same thing. And then, of course, on Friday, there was speculation because some meeting was going to happen. Now, what's your take on this whole idea that, we see commentary that has enormous impact on the markets, not only here, but in Europe or in Asia, all over the world. And yet, at the same time, they have, to this date, really, besides the LTRO, really have not been able to do anything beyond just commentary. Is there more behind this one?
Well, the main thing that needs to be understood about the Eurozone debt contagion is that the word debt is in the middle of it, okay? And what do we know about debt? Debts have to be paid back. Everything stems from that simple concept. So if you need to pay your debts and you don't have the money for it, what can you do? You know, you can inflate. If you're a government, you can print money to inflate it away. If you're a business, you can go bankrupt and write it down. And if you are a government or a central bank, you can also extend the terms. And I think what they're really trying to do right now in Europe is they're trying to extend the terms.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, what Draghi is talking about in terms of when he says we'll do whatever is necessary, all he's talking about is the European Central Bank and the other central banks of Europe buying the bonds of troubled countries like Italy and Spain, and then basically stashing them away in their vaults. But remember, those debts still have to be paid back.
Right.
You know, so unless they figure out some way to grow the economies so that those governments have the money and the wherewithal to pay off the bonds that they're selling to the ECB, nothing changes.
Then why is there such an incredible? I mean, when I say incredible, a ridiculous movement. Was it a short squeeze just over the top levels that was?
It's extending the terms. It's more like, well, we know that this has to, you know, money has to be paid. Greece, for instance, has staring down the barrel of a big payment that's due, and so is Spain and the Spanish regional governments. So, to the extent that potentially the ECB could be a buyer of the bonds that need to be rolled over, that extends the terms, and that could be a plus.
So now, with that happening, we saw, which was really interesting on Friday, because one of the things that has not happened up until Friday was the selling of U.S. bonds. There has been a constant bid, and we took the rate down on the 10-year down to 145, I think it was, last week. And then all of a sudden, on Friday, there was a real big sell-off. And obviously, you could infer from that what was happening was there was a lot of confidence, and they were actually going out and looking to roll that into maybe European bonds, because we know that there's going to be a meeting next week with the Fed, and who knows if they're going to start up some kind of either quantitative easing, whether it's now or a little bit later, whether it's going to be an Operation Twist. But even if it was, it's going to possibly hit the long bond. And people were that confident to sell off the long bond and look to make a profit possibly on either one of two things, either the markets or, you know, the equity markets, or the putting their money into European bonds. The fact, though, is that, or at least the premise here is that the Bundesbank is still dead against this. So how are they going to get over that hurdle?
Well, that's really the wild card, as you say, is the Bundesbank. Bundesbank, for those who don't know, is the central bank of Germany. And I don't think a lot of people understand something. The European Central Bank is the central bank for all of Europe, but each of the individual countries within the Eurozone have their own central banks. And most of them are considered to be fairly politicized. The one gold standard, so to speak, is the Bundesbank, which is the central bank of Germany, and they don't take. They're known for being very no nonsense, strictly by the book, very very data driven, and they've been the most adamant of all central banks against monetizing debt, which is to say, spending eurozone money to buy the bonds of troubled countries, and I think that they're going to stick to their guns. So I think there probably will be a headline next week that says Bundesbank, you know, drags heels, or one of the leaders makes a comment that makes it seem as if Draghi and Merkel and French President Prime Minister Hollande won't get their way. But ultimately, I think that the investors are going to ignore the Bundesbank's hesitation and give the ECB a break.
And so investors are going to be doing this. Now, I think it was back in June that Angela Merkel said that over her dead body that Europe debt won't be shared. And somehow now we're thinking she doesn't say that? You remember that whole commentary?
You know, nobody really knows what they're saying. It's always in translation. It's always from some third party. You know, it's always filtered in some way, so I really don't give much, I don't really pay much attention to what they're quoted as saying.
Yeah, I mean, because it was from unnamed sources.
At the end of the day, you just have to, you know, each of these countries that are party to the Eurozone have their own constituencies, and the main job of every politician is to stay in office. So they'll do whatever they can to stay in office. And right now, I think there's very little appetite within the German people, and why should there be, for bailing out the Spanish, the Greeks, the Portuguese. So there will be a lot of tension, but I think that for now, just for the summer, we may see an abatement of concern.
Well, that's interesting, because we keep on going through these rises and falls in very quick manner of, you know, with the hope of central banks around the world. I mean, really, if you think about what's happening, the economics in the United States are rolling over pretty hard. Estimates are being you know, lowered down, but, you know, at the same time, they have to be, because most economic reports have been showing a much slower economy. The 1.5% GDP that we saw last week was better than the 1.4 that was an estimate by on average, but only a few weeks before it was 1.9. So while it was better than expected, you know, you still have to consider that. The other thing is, let's talk about earnings season for a second. There is a chunk of companies that have reported earnings, and there's a reasonable amount of surprise to the upside. There's been a wide range on some companies. Again, we know that estimates have been brought down, but revenues really have been pretty much flat from what we're seeing overall. Ex-financial, I'm talking. You know, what's your take on that? I mean, you know, the revenue issue.
I think that the weakness we've seen over the past year has basically discounted these low revenues, and I think that investors, to a large part, have been discounting a recession, or at least a growth problem, or maybe not a recession, but a economy that's growing so slow that it might as well be a recession, right?
Yeah.
But if you look around, stocks have gone nowhere for the past year. Why is that? Well, investors have been expecting this. And what tends to happen next, I'm not saying it's going to, but I'm not promising that it's going to, but what tends to happen next is that investors look over the horizon and start to discount a recovery.
And that
could lead to an advance in August and even right up through the election. I still think that the market's going to have a lot of trouble in 2013, but you could have let's discount the recovery rally between now and November.
And then where do we go from there? I mean, we're going to hit the peaks again?
Well, you know, then you get to the fiscal cliff, and I doubt that the Congress is going to deal with it in an efficacious way. And then that will mean that there will be a fear that the Bush era tax rate cuts will be eliminated. The wealthier people will have to pay, basically go back to Clinton era tax rates. And also, businesses will have to pay more, and there'll be automatic cuts. I think that somehow Congress will either resolve the fiscal cliff after the election, or they'll put it off until the beginning of the first term of the next president,
mm-hmm.
Or the next term of Obama if he wins. And that's and all that turmoil, all that angst, I think will lead to a very difficult first and second quarter of next year.
Yeah, you also have to think about the kind of October time frame, because, you know, when you look out a few months in ahead and you look at, you know, what would possibly occur during a, questioning of, okay, here we are, and maybe we're muddling along in terms of economics and earnings and all that. And then all of a sudden, you know, you say, hey, what's going to happen? And, you know, we both know that the market just really doesn't like confusion. They don't like to have an unknown out there.
You know, people always say the market doesn't like confusion, but in fact, good investors love uncertainty if they are certain, right?
Well,
so the market can be uncertain, but if you're certain, then you can take advantage of the uncertainty. That's our whole job. That's what buying low is. And so,
right. Assuming you're in the right positioning, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So one thing that we've learned over the past 3 years is that although the economy has been slowing, and although average earnings growth of all companies aggregated together is lower, there are certain sectors and there are certain companies that are basically, there are many companies in some sectors that are dealing with the slowdown in a very effective way.
Yep.
You know, look at healthcare. Healthcare companies, particularly the drug makers, are huge winners in, under the Obamacare format. Now, they'll have more people to sell drugs to. And those companies, Merck, Pfizer, et cetera, are at 4 or 5 year highs. Amgen, the big biotech, which has been languishing for like 7 or 8 years, actually hit a new high on Friday. So I think the healthcare sector is very healthy. Walmart and other companies that sell drugs in bulk are also doing well because they get more reimbursements under the Obamacare plan. Energy companies, surprisingly, even though oil and gas prices have been so volatile, are also trading at new highs. Did you know that Exxon and Chevron hit new highs on Friday?
Yeah. Now, all these that you mentioned here, by the way, are all big caps.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a reflection of individual and institutional investors' a concern about the prognosis for smaller companies.
Right.
And that's a reflection of their uncertainty. But
you know, it's been interesting.
There have been many successful markets, contrary to what you hear from some authorities. There have been many good successful markets that have been led by big caps.
Yeah, I hear you. Here's something interesting.
I'll give you one incredible example.
Yeah.
1998, 1999 was terrible for small caps. Yet it was one of the best 2 years for the market.
Yeah, and that was, as a matter of fact, it was a terrible couple of years for value. It was all growth related.
Right.
As a matter of fact, value was just obliterated. That's when, if you remember, there was a kind of really interesting thing, and I look back, it was two of the big money managers, that were private money managers, you had Bernstein and Northern Trust. Northern Trust was a growth player, and they had one platform, one way to go, and Bernstein had another. They had value. So Bernstein was really great, doing great through that time, right up until 2000. And at the same time, Northern Trust was doing really well during that time, and Bernstein was just, it was horrible. Well, what happened was a lot of people took their money out of Bernstein and went to Northern Trust in 2000 and then just got obliterated. And Northern Trust decided, and did Bernstein at the time, hey, you know what, we can't do this. We need to be more of a value and growth shop. Each one of them bought another money manager so they can expand their overall reach into value and growth and vice versa, depending on who we were looking at. Fascinating kind of change at the time because both of them were hardcore in their particular sector expertise.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
the bottom line for individuals, for stocks is earnings growth, right?
Right. Yes.
It's earnings growth plus PE. So price earnings multiples are the hidden lever that push stock prices up. And one of the hidden things that push PEs around is inflation. So when inflation is low, PEs tend to rise. So even though the economy is relatively soft, companies themselves have figured out ways to pull the levers within their own organizations, either by hiring less people or using technology more effectively, to boost their earnings. And at the same time, because inflation is low, PEs have been allowed to stabilize, not exactly grow, but they've been able to stabilize and in some cases expand. So you have these sort of two strangely hidden factors that are actually boosting prices. And if you look at some of the best companies in the world, we're talking about Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, they're all trading at new highs. Why is that?
Well, I mean,
because they're survivors, because they understand their managers understand the environment and how to, you know, make money for customers. And unfortunately, there are some companies that aren't getting it done. You know, I think Apple is a great example of a company that's really troubling to me right now. Apple, obviously the largest company in the world under the growth CEO and founder Steve Jobs,
mm-hmm.
it's really faltered in the last 6 months. And why is that? It's amazing, but it's really failed to innovate. And this is a company that's known for its innovation. It's truly failed to innovate. They missed an entire product cycle by not bringing out a new iPhone this year or in the last 9 months, while its rival Google has. And that has really spooked investors, and it's really harmed their stock price. So, you know.
Well, the stock price really isn't that far off from its high.
Pardon me?
Its stock price is not that far off from its high, but what you're saying is it should be higher considering all things involved with Apple, right? And
I'm saying that certain technology companies in particular have obsolescence problems. So even though Apple was the winner of the innovation sweepstakes of the past 2 years, it's so easy for other companies to copy their success and push it forward and then drive down margins, and that's what's happening with Apple right now. It's less easy for industrial and, say, healthcare companies it's less easy for competitors to push down the margins and price and to out-innovate companies like Coca-Cola and Johnson & Johnson. So I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing these technology companies falter right now.
Well, one of the things also, I'll tell you something interesting, that over the last, I'll say 2 years or so, maybe a little bit longer than that, probably a little bit longer than that, Apple has come up on a screen. We have a variety of different screens that we utilize for equities.
Yeah.
Apple has been on that screen forever. Okay, it's. I don't remember really in some time it being off. You know what? After its earnings, it fell off. And that's
really
kind of interesting, yeah, because it failed on margins and it failed on growth of EPS.
Yeah, well, you know, when you get to the very top, there's only one way to go.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There are not very many companies that have been at the very top of the market cap leadership board for more than a year or two. Walmart was at the top for a long time. ExxonMobil was at the top for a long time, for a while. Technology companies have achieved the very top for short periods of time and then fallen off. The most vivid example is Microsoft.
Yeah, clearly. So let's talk about Amazon's earnings that came out. Now, two things. Let me just back up and say that if any other company put out the earnings that Apple put out in terms of the miss and downside guidance.
Amazon?
No, I'm talking about Apple for a second, just looking back for a second. If we look at Apple and look at their earnings, and if any other company was out there, not any company, but a lot of companies out there that would have put out the earnings that they put out with the downside guidance that they put out, the stock would have been obliterated, right? Would you agree?
Yes.
And Apple's down 4%, down another couple of cents the next day, and then it comes back up, and it's maybe off, I don't know, 3 or 4% from where it was before the earnings. Now, Amazon comes out, and they do what Amazon does. Amazon, I put out a tweet about this, as a matter of fact, that when you look at the Amazon numbers, you can't look at the headline. You can't look at even the next layer down. You have to really dig in to figure out what's going on with Amazon, because they put out a very strange, at least I've noticed, they put out a strange earnings report. There's a lot of things embedded. You got to subtract. You got to put back in. Amazon drops about 7% after hours because they put in a pretty, I would say, a pretty awful number and a pretty awful outlook. I mean, very big miss. And yet the stock dips, and then the next day, magically, which has happened several times, by the way, in the last several quarters, Amazon is up dramatically the next day. About 8% it closed on Friday. Now, the reason is that I'm hearing is, what they're doing, it's so wonderful. They're taking money and they're putting it back into the company to build for the future. They're building distribution facilities. They're taking that money and doing a lot of a move that will really benefit them in the future. Now, That's great. But again, if any other company put out an earnings number like they put out with the information, it would be down 25%. So what is
take
on this?
It's kind of it's a fantastic investing anomaly right now that Apple, with all the growth and all the success that it has had over the years, it's trading at a forward price earnings multiple of about 13 right now,
right,
or 12, whereas Amazon, which regularly puts up losses on a sort of a pro forma basis, is trading at a PE of over 100. And the question is, why is that? Well, one of the main things is this whole innovation obsolescence cycle that we talked about. You know, investors are very concerned that Apple will lose its perch, just like Nokia did, just like Research in Motion did, just like Dell did. And people forget Dell was up 70,000% in the 1990s.
And was that what it was, 70,000%?
And ever since... Pardon me?
That's a big number. Same thing as Cisco. Huge
numbers. Cisco, same thing, up about 40,000% in the 1990s, could do no wrong, and now look at it. It's just a shamble of its previous self. AOL, another great example, up 80,000% in the 1990s, and now it almost, it's an afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
And people see that, long-term investors see the same potential glide path for Apple. You know, important for a short period of time, and then potentially being outflanked by its own success as its competitors rip off its business model and its products and drive down margins. But then you turn around and look at Amazon. All they've done is become the most dominant player in the most important two fields in American business, in world business, and that is online commerce. They do 48% of all online commerce, and the bigger they get, on an underlying basis, the more profitable they get, and that's what investors are looking at.
But at the same time, you have to strip out the fact that they keep on investing. I guess the thesis is, by an investor buying into it, is, you know what, we're patient, and when they do finally turn off the, I'm not calling buybacks, but the putting back the earnings into
reinvestment.
Yeah. Over time.
They're investing in their business.
Yeah.
They're building DCs. You know, if you think about, you know, what they do, let's say the thing that really paralyzes a lot of big retailers is that, let's say you have you're a retailer and you have 100 stores and you sell Levi's. Well, you have to buy, 100 sets of Levi's in depth, all the sizes, all the colors, and you have to put them in every single freaking store, right?
Right.
But Amazon doesn't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon only has to buy for their distribution centers, and so they don't have all the costs that hold back the big retailers, and they don't have to manufacture. They don't have all the difficulties and dangers of manufacturing product either, like Apple does.
Right.
It's really an amazing business model, and I think Jeff Bezos doesn't get enough credit for what he's built.
The other thing is that he also has an army of people selling his products, if you think about it, because he has all these various people that have websites and things like that that may promote it and send you over there because they're making a fee on it.
And then they use all their excess capacity on their computers for another huge business, which is their data warehousing and
AWS. Have you ever checked that out?
They provide supercomputer type of computing capacity to small business, to startups, and all kinds of other businesses around the country.
Yeah, I mean, they have their AWS service. I was on there because we use part of that for some of the things we do, and it is a really neat program.
Their AWS is absolutely fantastic.
That's unbelievable.
It's really one of the hidden levers behind their success.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And explain to people what that is.
Yeah, basically they have things like... it's their web services, and basically what they have is you can run your website off of there, and it integrates databases. It brings in things like automated SMS and text messaging, and it's just a whole host of things there, and it's so easily bid. It's basically...
what's amazing is they have people all the way from the large startups and large companies, actually, all the way down to people like me.
Yeah.
I run my business off of AWS, and the service is great. The price is fantastic, and it really works.
Yeah,
I just think that you think about it. What they're doing is they're utilizing a lot of excess capacity on their own computers, the stuff that they're running their own business on. It's as if, think about this. Think about it this way. Imagine you have a large company like, let's say, Exxon, and across the country, maybe it has 100,000, maybe it owns 100,000 offices around the country. I don't know what the number is, but let's just say. But every night, people leave those offices, and those offices are empty, right,
mm-hmm.
for 15 hours, say from 6 p.m. until 8 a.m. the next morning, okay? All that is wasted capacity. What Amazon is doing is they're saying, on their computers, we're taking excess capacity and renting it out.
Right, right.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, no, it's efficiency. It's like my favorite example of the perfect business to have. It would be a sushi shop combination bait store. You know, you have sushi during the night, and you, the next day you don't sell it, you send it out to bait.
That's a good one. Try that.
Listen, Amazon's
quite a brilliant company, and I think that they've surprised people. And if you look at it, I think they hit a new high on Friday, an all-time high.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you've been really writing about quite often, and you've been, I guess I would say probably quite an expert on something right now, which is the emerging growth stocks. This is an interesting place to look because, we talk about the big caps, we talk about all this, but yet at the same time, what are the newer companies that really have an opportunity to, kind of blossom? Now, obviously...
Yeah, exactly. Who is the next Amazon?
Right. Yeah.
And Amazon... obviously, you'd love to be able to get in on that. And early on, people forget that Amazon, when it first went public, 1997, 98, it pulled a Facebook. Basically, it went public at
pulled
a relatively high level.
Pulled a Facebook? Oh, man, that's not what they're going to say, are they?
It fell by about 45% in its first couple months. Do you know that?
Well, I remember that a lot of people were really negative. Alan Abelson from the Barron's was like just always trashing the company.
Yeah, so they fell about 45%, and then they went on to gain about 2,000% over the next, like, 2 years. And then as they were building out, people who didn't really understand what they were doing, they went through this long period of flatness, basically, at a low level. And then once people realized what Bezos was building, then it started to rev back up in 2003, and now it's, you know, at this new high. But, you know, you look around and you say to yourself, well, what is that next Amazon? How do I find out what it is? Well, you know, it's never going to be a secret, right? It's got to go through everything. To get to be a stock that's up 10,000%, you've got to go through a few hurdles first.
Yeah, exactly.
First, you've got to be up 5,000%. You've got to be up 2,000%. You've got to be up 1,000%. You've got to be up 500%, right? You've got to be up 100%. So, you know, we've got to find those companies that have the capacity to move through those hurdles. And generally speaking, these companies are ones that have the ones we look at for what we call emerging growth are companies that have that are profitable and have gone public within the last year and a half and have been successful in that first year and a half. So basically, those are small cap stocks. Could be in any industry, doesn't have to be technology, could be food, could be retail or whatever. Looking at companies that have been, as I say, when they went public in the last year and a half, have been successful out of that IPO, but not wildly successful, but are just making steady progress. And those are the companies I'm interested in my emerging growth.
So give me some examples. I mean, we think of the names out there that have been just totally obliterated, like a Zynga or, you know.
So Zynga is a fantastic example of what I'm not looking for.
Right.
Zynga
okay.
has no business plan.
Right.
How that company ever went public is, to me, is just a complete outrage.
Well, it was interesting at the beginning because they were really kind of all about the Facebook thing. So people were kind of really thinking that was great. But, I mean,
well,
after that.
They just throw that word around, that Facebook thing, right?
Yep.
But they don't really have a business plan. All they do is they sell virtual money to people in virtual games. And if we know one thing about gaming is that its popularity is very fickle.
Mm-hmm.
Just ask Electronic Arts.
Yeah. You have Groupon. What about Groupon's another one?
Pardon me?
Groupon is another one that recently came public.
Yeah, Groupon is another company with a very faulty business plan. So those are the kind of companies where they might start off with an initial pop, but then they progressively just go lower and lower as people get a closer look at what they do.
All right, so let's hear about some of the
ones
I'm
not looking at companies like that.
Okay, what are you looking at?
Well, I like companies like Splunk, S-P-L-K.
Mm-hmm.
It's a company that is looking at the issues of big data. Basically, all the data that companies generate in the course of their daily business have not really been searchable and analyzable in an effective way. And Splunk has the capacity to help companies do that. They've got a lot of momentum in selling their data capture and analysis programs to companies around the world. It's down about 15% in the last 3 months, and that's one I would look at on this recent dip.
Okay, who else? Give me another example. Are they a lot of technology companies?
I mean, that's SPLK.
Yeah, are they a lot of technology
another
companies?
Another company that's gone public recently is Vocera Communications, VCRA, trading around 27 now. It does. It's sort of a healthcare IT company. They basically make communication systems within hospitals.
Hmm.
So if you're a doctor or a nurse, it's the most effective way of communicating information within a hospital is through the Vocera Communications networks. And these are extremely popular now and growing to be more so, especially under Obamacare, where more people have access to health care.
All right. Give me one more.
Ellie Mae is a company I like a lot. Have you heard of that one? ELLI?
ELLI. Does it have anything to do with loans?
Yes, it does. Very good.
There you go. Thank you.
For some reason, they decided to model their name after Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which I think is hilarious since they were so unsuccessful.
Because everybody hates them. Yeah.
Ellie Mae is not a lender. What it does is it's a software maker that makes software used by people in the real estate industry. So you ever, if you anybody who's bought a house or a condo, will remember having to spend like an hour and a half signing a whole bunch of documents. Remember
mm-hmm.
that?
Mm-hmm.
And then you forget where those documents are, and
right.
it's a huge paper mess. Well, Ellie Mae has done a tremendous job of automating and streamlining that process, and it's as the real estate. As we've had a rebound in real estate sales in the United States, Ellie Mae has been a tremendous technology play on that revival.
Interesting.
So I really like that one a lot.
A lot of technology.
Still a small company.
Yep. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Pardon me?
Good stuff.
Another company that I like a lot is a data warehousing, and I'm sorry, a data farm company based in Europe called Interaction. I don't know how to pronounce it. Intersection.
Yep.
Symbol is INXN. It is a one of the, it's a company that, it's a type of company that's been successful in the United States and was not widely done in Europe. And so they've taken a U.S. concept of the data farm and they've moved it to Europe.
That's like
and,
a Rackspace, for example.
INXN.
So that's like a John. It's like a Rackspace.
Pardon me?
It's like a Rackspace.
Excuse me.
It's like a Rackspace Holdings.
Yeah, similar to a Rackspace, where another big one in the United States is called Equinix.
Yeah.
EQIX.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, let's not go through all these. You know, you can find John's writings on, where do you write? You write for MarketWatch, TheStreet.com. You have four investment newsletters. One's about futures. One's about more of a long-term investing through ETFs.
Yeah, so my long-term letter comes out daily is Strategic Advantage. That's the best place to start. Just go to markmancapital.net, and you can sign up there for a free two-week trial. I also put out a daily trading letter called Trader's Advantage, and you can search for that just using Trader's Advantage or my name, johnmarkman.com. That does short-term stocks and options. And then I have two futures newsletters, Gemini 252, which covers the E-mini timing, as well as bond, two-year note bond timing, and Gemini SGX, which covers the Russell 2000 E-mini.
That one moves around.
For me, it moves around a lot.
Yeah.
It gives us a lot of fantastic opportunities for making money.
We've done,
done really well with that one. So,
Good stuff. Listen, John Markman, I appreciate it. We'll put all your information on the DisciplineInvestor.com show notes for this particular episode. And we'll have you back soon because you always bring all sorts of interesting information. And I like how you, when you go through your various analogs and kind of come up with some things that may be beneficial. But also, I think it's refreshing that you have a very, I think I would say a neutral stance on markets in that what they do is what they do and not trying to be one way or the other. Like a lot of times, you know, you find that many investing folks have, you know, hey, they're always bullish or they're always bearish. And you know, it all depends on the market conditions, really, what's happening. And there's always opportunity in some stock out there or some sector, I guess.
Well, just keep in mind, there's nothing more bullish than a new high.
Right.
And Merck, you know, look at these drug, look at the Spider consumer staples, new high. Spider healthcare, new high, all-time high. Exxon and Chevron up, you know, up new highs. This is a pretty bullish environment despite the news. So, because companies have figured out how to make money in this environment. So, I think people have to take a deep breath and be willing to put their money to work.
One of the things is, I'll just close on this, that there are some that say that the staples, the healthcare, the utilities making relatively new highs is a bullish environment for those particular sectors, but not a bullish environment for other sectors because those are considered the defensive sectors most of the time.
Right. But, you know, don't they say that defense wins Super Bowls?
Yeah, I guess so. Defense, defense, defense.
That.
I agree. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Good stuff. Good stuff. All right, let's talk a little bit about what's going on next week in terms of economics. Now, next week is a big week. This week is a big week, I should say, because we have Bernanke that's going to be having a two-day meeting of the central bankers, and come out with some kind of announcement of some sort. A lot of people are thinking that there's going to be an extension of maybe Operation Twist, some other discussion about the extension of the interest rates being low till maybe 2060 or something like that. There's going to be the potential for maybe an announcement of a new QE program. I'll tell you something, that it is all very possible. It all depends on what happens when we see some of the results of what's going on in Europe. Now, Europe also has a meeting on Thursday where they may, in fact, reduce rates again. They reduced it by a quarter point to one of the lowest, if not the lowest, levels in the history of the Euro region. And we'll see, you know, kind of how they try to massage all this together. But there clearly is a coordinated effort going on by central bankers. We've talked about that. And again, the problem is, though, that even though this is really good for stocks and potentially even possibly good for bonds at the same time, you know, you have to wonder how long that lasts, because there have been times before where you do see that markets will in fact move much higher due to central bank intervention or easing stimulus. At the same time, when do fundamentals take over? In the last several weeks, we've seen stock after stock come in and report earnings a little bit lower, which we've just a moment talked about. And at the same time, EPS, that's growing slightly. Now, hopefully what we're finding is that companies, again, are able to cut their expenses and do a really good job at that, creating an environment for themselves that they can have a higher earnings. Very simple. That's all that really matters. At the end of the day, how much is the company making and are they making more money? And regardless of the revenue, regardless of anything else, the fact is whether they're cutting expenses, whether they're doing better in terms of refinancing, finding new markets, expanding, acquiring, merging, whatever it may be, it's good. So just consider that. But the backdrop also has to be good to make stocks really, you know, get some good traction so they can continue to move higher as a group. Individual stocks, on the other hand, could, you know, do a lot of different things together and move. But at the same time, realize that there is this kind of overhang right now. Now, what I want to talk about is we have probably the most important numbers that are going to shape the markets aside from the central bank. We have four things happening that I see it, right? We have, there's a lot of things happening on the economic front. Again, we put all this list all the time on Mondays on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But you have, you have Case-Shiller numbers on Tuesday. You have consumer confidence on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we have the ADP numbers. We have, of course, the central banks we talked about. But on Friday, we have, of course, the big NFP payrolls number. Right now, they're looking at about 100,000 person bill jobs gained and about an 8.2 rate for unemployment. Now, it's been very difficult to handicap what's gone on with jobs, because the initial claims are really just, they have so much seasonality that are built into it right now that it's very difficult, because what's going on with the auto manufacturers and the shutdowns and not shutdowns. And so that number's been a little bit volatile on a weekly basis. But overall, we're seeing about a 370, 365 average on a weekly basis. That's not a good number to increase the overall payrolls. Now, we'll see what the ADP number says on Wednesday, and they have been somewhat close and correlated with the NFP payrolls on Friday. So right now we're looking at about, you know, again, 100,000, probably 85 to about a 120 is the number that you want to see before markets get hysterical in any direction. And then on top of that, there's about, we put up a post about 161 stocks of interest that are going to be posting this week. So you have a lot of earnings coming into play this week. And, you know, what we saw last week was kind of like Starbucks gets crushed, but yet, you know, on a bad number and a poor outlook and a higher cost, et cetera. And then at the same time, Amazon, who had a terrible number, goes up. So you're going to have to watch these reversal points right now and find out where things are going. We also have, stocks that are really setting up very nicely right here. So what I want you to consider and I want you to think about right now, very carefully and very seriously, is that this is probably the clearest definition and example of a stock picker's market that you can have. That doesn't mean you have to be a good stock picker. That's not what I'm saying. But individual stocks that have good fundamentals, good charting patterns, are probably your best bet right now than just an overall average, if you can do a good job and, you know, research them and figure out which particular stocks are the play, which is not very easy, but it is something that you really should consider right now. You know, that's kind of the play that you want to look at. And at the same time, you know, realize that these food costs are really, and energy costs and materials costs have escalated, not in every position, but escalated. And consider, hey, this is an interesting time to consider staying away from that area. We actually reshorted Buffalo Wild Wings last week. We are also looking at many of the banks that kind of moved up to resistance and kind of started to come down, and other companies that have said that they have higher costs involved in what they're doing. And as they picked up last week towards the end on Friday, we shorted a few of those, added to our companies that have been doing well. We're looking for Herbalife next week. This should be very interesting. I want you to watch this company. They're coming out with earnings. And if, in fact, they come out with a reasonable number and we don't have David Einhorn on the phone, it could be an unbelievable blowout here, because that stock was totally obliterated for what I would say was less than no reason, just on some fears. So consider that. And, you know, realize that there are several names when you're looking at technology that have been terribly sold right now. And you want to wonder, hey, is this the kind of time you want to, as we talked about a moment ago, move into the staples, into the, you know, alternative assets, and kind of watch your portfolio to rebuild there and kind of slant it that way. So that's all that going on. Now, I'm going to have a lot about stocks next week on the disciplinedinvestor.com. So I want you to make sure to check that out. And of course, if you're looking for management of your money and you kind of want someone to actively trade it, and you're looking for something a little bit different than just the markets out there, where you can have short positions, as we talk about, long positions, et cetera, and a transparent environment, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and take a look at the 14-minute, 13-minute, 12-minute, depending on how it plays, video that will give you a virtual tour of what we do. Maybe it's time. Coming into the end of the summer, into September, October, kind of those very volatile months, and we will do our best to help you out. And on that, we're going to end this show. I want to thank you for joining us. We have lots of great stuff coming up, as always. And if you have any suggestions, please send them my way. Any good people that you think should be on, I'll be happy to take a look at it. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Have a great week, and let's watch all those numbers closely. Check out that cheat sheet that I put on the site for economics and for earnings. This will give you an idea of how to kind of, you know, judge what's going on as compared to what the expectations are. Again, thanks for joining me. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.